Hello, this is David Lloyd with a Radio Moments Techniques special. In 2012, a little teenage lad called Joshua was riding to school on his bike, and he was knocked off by a car. He died 11 days later in intensive care. As you'd expect, his mum, Faith, was at his bedside, and at that stage she chose to speak to several reporters about his death because she wanted to raise money to build a skate park in his memory. But how did she feel about those journalists in those harrowing days? That's the sort of insight you can read in a new book called Trauma Reporting, A Journalist's Guide to Covering Sensitive Stories. It's been written by an old colleague of mine, Joe Healy, now working for the BBC. And Joe told me more about why this subject mattered to her.
The reality is that so many of us as journalists so regularly can be working so closely with people who are emotionally really fragile. They're ordinary people like you and me to whom something extraordinarily bad or difficult has happened, and they choose to talk to us about it. I mean, what a privilege is that?
But they haven't chosen to be in the news, have they?
Absolutely often. Really not, no. And we're there for often truly devastating reasons, and that's a very important thing for journalists to realise, you know, that these aren't people that we interview regularly, that understand the filming process, the interview process. But yes, they are very much at the heart of this work, and over 30 plus years as a journalist in newspapers, radio and TV, I've worked out that, crikey, I've interviewed hundreds of people who've told me their sensitive stories, and yet we have no training to be in there. We're probably the only professionals who are invited into these homes, into these high octane emotional homes, with no training, no fundamental basic training in how to work with people who've suffered a traumatic experience and still are suffering. And if you think about that in this day and age, that's actually quite shocking, isn't it? Surely they deserve a better deal. So they're very much at the heart of it. And actually, do you know what? You're right. It is a passion, but it's an informed passion, I would describe it as.
The book is based on your experiences, but also you've talked to a whole load of other people. Who did you talk to?
We have an in-depth look from someone who's quite a high-profile journalist. In one case, a particularly extremely high-profile journalist is Louis Theroux, who very generously gave me loads of time for this book. I mean, how impressive is that? You know, what a nice guy. And he said, interestingly, right at the start, Joe, I need to add the rider here that I haven't been trained to work sensitively with people. And I said, that's the purpose of the book, because none of us has. And how incredible is that? He very generously shared how he works with people sensitively, what he does when they cry, lessons that he's learnt, how a professional relationship may look to him. And also, you know, I think very candidly really shares when he wasn't sure if he got it quite right. Yeah, they were interviewing. He describes a situation where he was interviewing a young woman who I think had been trafficked, and she was doing an interview in a hotel room. And there was he suddenly became aware there was a male cameraman, a male sound recordist. He was male. The producer was male. And there they were with this poor young lass in a hotel room. And he said, and I realised that, of course, wasn't at all conducive to making her feel safe. Equally, he describes when he was working with a mother whose teenage son had autism, and suddenly he kicked off and the mum had to sit on her son, I think, to restrain him. Louis felt, whoa, we shouldn't be filming this. It's too intense, too intimate. But actually, she said, keep filming. This is what it's all about. This is what I want people to see. It goes back to listening to our interviewees, listening to them, putting them at the heart of the work, which I do, putting them at the heart of the book, which I do, and asking them how sensitivity and respect may look to them. And as I think I say at the start, there are surprises. You know, what we assume is sensitivity actually to some people may not be. There can't be a one-size-fits-all, clearly, and that's terribly important to realise as well.
The really interesting thing about your book is you've spoken to people on the other side, people who have been through this, and you've had some absolutely fascinating conversations with how they view their experiences. One example, Faith, a mother of a teenage lad, gets knocked off his bike, gets killed. She, of course, is headline news. She's raising fundraising, as many people do in situations like that. And what do you recall of Faith's experience? Because it seemed to be quite a typical one that you quote a lot.
Faith is actually very special to me. We keep in touch now, and she was one of the mums who was very supportive of me doing this book, which I think is in common with all the people who've shared their stories and shared their experiences of working with journalists at intensely, you know, traumatic times for them. I mean, and yet they're prepared generously to share what that was like to help us do our jobs better. I think that's amazing. Faith is a mum who's actually similar age to me, and she had two sons and I have two daughters. We have quite a lot in common.
Just let me stop you on that, because a lot more to say about this, but there, the empathy. You've got two children, yeah. She's got two children. But you do say also in the book, be careful not to assume too much. Be careful not to say, I understand, because in many situations, you probably don't.
It's one of the worst things you can say, is actually, I know how you feel. I understand what you're going through, because you absolutely don't. And even if you've been through something similar, you still don't know what they're going through. And parents and people generally tell me that they find that quite offensive, actually, which isn't rocket science if you think about it. But
so how do you empathize? How do you get on the same level? You said you got to, you know, you felt an affinity. How did you sort of begin to get that across?
Well, just taking back on that point, because there is one really important reflection that Rose, whose daughter died, shares. And she just, in the book, and it's just so impactful, I have to tell you, she says that one reporter, when she was doing an interview about, when he knew that she was a bereaved mum, said to her, oh, he said, I know exactly how you feel. My dog died. I mean, I know. And she said, Rose said to me, I just looked at him and thought, what planet is this man on? I think there is this need, going to your question about empathy, there is this need sometimes to over-empathise, to connect in a way that actually can be wholly inappropriate. I mean, clearly that's a very clear example. In fact, it doesn't require over-empathising. And as journalists, that's not our job. We're not their best friend. We're not their advocate. And that's important. You know, we are there to do a decent job of telling their story, and to treat them with dignity while we do it.
One
and empathy,
though,
a big thing with empathy is it's just going to sound funny now because you've just interrupted, is actually to listen. But it is, and lovely Faith, if she was here now, would be laughing alongside me, because empathy is a big element of it, is actually what so many people don't do, sit and listen and take note of their opinions. What we may think the story is may not be what they're trying to tell us. And it's really important, appropriate eye contact, reflecting back what they've said and really listening. Now, you're frightened to ask me a question now, aren't you?
Don't say a word. No, what I was going to say was, you gave one, it's this tiny little tip just about the fact you can empathise with the practicalities, you know, long journeys to the hospital, these things where people know you do understand, those sorts of basic entrees, if you like, to a dialogue.
And that's such a good tip, isn't it? And that was given to me, and it's something I've used but hadn't really thought about it, but that tip was given to me by a planning journalist who is endlessly contacting people about sensitive stories and talking to them. And she's in the book, and she says that sometimes, yes, when they're talking about a child's illness or a rare illness or a long-term illness or any number of stories that we may be covering, to actually say about the journey to the hospital, maybe the cost of the parking or the... So that your empathy, you appreciate the surroundings without trying to say you know what they're going through, because you don't.
And I guess also it's about making them feel at home and probably a little more in control of the situation.
Control is a huge theme of the book. And just the other day, a young reporter rang me and asked about how do I deal? I'm going to interview two students, one who's been raped and one who has suffered an attempted rape. Where do I start? And I just said, really, it is so important, and it gets reflected throughout the book, to give people, particularly people actually who have been abused, some sense of control over the way that you are working with them, because trauma can be so disempowering. It's overwhelming. It's overwhelming in a bad way. It's very unlike the journalism that people perceive, where you interview a police official or a chief of police or a business head of a business. In those cases, we're on the back foot and we are trying to elicit information from them. In these sorts of interviews, it's a complete reversal. They're the ones who are disempowered and lacking in control. We're the ones who tend to have control. We need to be really respectful of that. And this can be done in all sorts of ways. It can be little things like when you get to their home. First, I have to say, as a human level, something that journalists don't often do, which families have asked for, is just to acknowledge if it's a bereavement. Journalists don't tend to say, "I'm really sorry for what you're going through." But families say, "We really value that." So now, through my training that I do, I bring that in. But also, in terms of control, you're in their home. They're not used to a reporter or a cameraman being in their home. So they may offer you a cup of tea. And I would say, accept the hospitality, because it's a ritual they're used to. It gives them a chance to get used to you being there. It gives them some control. It's what they do when people go round. But crucially, it also, from a journalist's point of view, gives you a chance to sit with them and to verify facts, check the facts, check the chronology. And sometimes trauma can disorganise people's memories and the way they're thinking. So it's very important to sit and check, you know, the chronology, the events, the names, the ages, the spellings, because the tiniest inaccuracies will cause the greatest of distresses. It's a huge insult often. I mean, I'm trying not to generalise too much here.
The example you used there was James Bulger, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, that he was, when it was, I mean, such a tragic story, but his mum was interviewed and she said that just one element of the anger that surrounded that case was that some journalists were referring to him as Jamie, but he'd always been James. And these sorts of things are really important. Can't stress enough for journalists how important it is to get things right.
To what extent is it tempting as a journalist to anticipate how an individual is going to deal with this terrible situation?
I think we do it as journalists. I think we do it as human beings, don't we? We make assumptions all the time. And a big message in this book is actually not to, and also to try and avoid judging as well. We're not there in the stories that we talk about in this book, and we do loads of them. We're not there to hold people to account. We're there to hear their accounts in the best way we can for them, for us, and for our output. And therefore, really important to, again, this skill of listening. And also trying, what I'm hoping the book will do is empowering journalists of all levels of experience, but particularly young journalists who are coming in, to almost defend and protect their interviewees. They're the ones who are working at the sharp end with them. They're the ones who are sitting with them and asking them to do things, to be involved and building up the trust. If you then have a producer or an editor who's had no involvement in that relationship, making unreasonable demands, I'm really hoping this will empower journalists to actually defend their interviewees.
So I'm sitting with somebody, I've persuaded my way into their home, I'm looking into their eyes. What questions are useful?
If I can just pick up on the persuading your way in, I think it's really, really important to flag up that there's that any form of overly persuasive pressure, deceit, the things that, again, are traditionally played out on dramas and all the rest of it, is
inappropriate. Let's come back to that one, because you've got some frightening examples, haven't you?
Yeah.
But let's do it now. The biscuit tin.
Yeah, that was after, yes, it was a bribe, wasn't it, of £2,000 inside a biscuit tin. That came directly from the Kerslake review into the Manchester Arena attack. And there was clear bad practice, which was highlighted, where journalists broke the news of a death to the children at the door, where, yes, they put money in a biscuit tin in the hospital, or they rang pretending to be a bereavement nurse. So clearly there is bad practice, but do you know what? And I hope this book is testament to it. There's also swathes of good practice of journalists who care. I mean, 700 journalists have chosen to come on my course to teach them how to work well with people who are vulnerable. Some of them have come in on their days off, and I know that to everyone it really matters to them to get it right. So I feel I have to kind of bang the drum there to all the people who are actually doing a really decent job, who I think is the majority. And the reality is, unless you do a decent job, you won't get a decent story. You know, it's and one of the women who shared her story makes that very clear. You know, she worked far better and gave far better interviews to people who treated her with some sort of understanding and respect and who listened.
So back to the conversation itself, and you talk about the dangers of why, and also help me understand to ascertain how an interviewee is feeling when you don't want to ask what might seem an insensitive or cliched question.
Yeah, I mean, the interview, the way that you interview someone, again, there can't be, as I said, a prescriptive approach. But fundamentally, the techniques that journalists are taught or can be taught, and often at university, of interviewing, to be incisive, to be challenging, maybe a bit combative, to be a bit interrogative, are wholly inappropriate with someone who is suffering, who is disempowered through trauma. So when you are working with someone who's been sexually abused as a child, it is really important to appreciate some of the trauma around that, to appreciate that they may have a fundamental need to be believed because they may well have tried to disclose as a child and not been believed, to be understood, to be listened to. And therefore, yeah, there are certain questions that can be wholly inappropriate. A why question can move into kind of a very interrogative sounding question. It doesn't mean you can't ask tough questions, of course you can, but there's no reason why you can't prepare them beforehand, talk it through with them. Then you're not there to trick them or to catch them out or to, you know, fire questions at them. So why wasn't he wearing a bike helmet would have been a wholly inappropriate question for Faith, whose son Josh, who we've mentioned, was cycling to school and was knocked off his bike and died 11 days later in intensive care with Faith, when Faith had to agree to life support being withdrawn. Now, Josh wasn't wearing a bike helmet. It wouldn't have made an ounce of difference as to what happened to Joshua. But that kind of question needed asking in a far more sensitive way and preparing someone for it to be asked.
How do you do that?
And in fact, I'll give you a really good example from Richard Bilton. He had to ask the McCanns about being a Guido not long after Madeleine McCann had gone missing. And as he shares in the book, and he now works for Panorama, he's been BBC special correspondent, he said that I had to ask the question. But what he did was he told them first, obviously this is out there, I have to ask you about it. And he prepared them for the question he was going to ask, and they accepted that. And he says there's never been a time when anyone has reacted badly to him asking a difficult question, but because he's asked it in a certain way. And what he does say is it's actually, however, completely unacceptable to play fast and loose with the facts, so that you're asking them questions when it's unjustified, when there's nothing out there, you're just firing questions.
Is it okay to say, how are you feeling?
Interesting one. It's the most hated question in America. As journalists, we have to ask the six fundamentals, don't we? Why, where, when, how, who, and all the rest of it. But with these sorts of interviews, there is a certain obligation, professional obligation, to appreciate the emotional impact of what's happened to our interviewees. And quite often it's something they want to share. It can be why they're talking to us. However, the how do you feel question can pitch them right back into the sort of visceral feeling of the time and this sense of, you know, reliving. However, it can be asked in a more effective way, actually. By that I mean that they can more coherently explain what they're going through by asking, what has the impact been on you of what's happened? Or you can actually ask a cognitive question which will get a feeling answer. So the trauma expert in the book suggests, what did you think about that? What do you think now about what happened to you? And then that will bring out a feeling response. So it's just being a little bit careful with it. And it can happen. I mean, I've certainly done interviews where they've got talking and then I might a little bit further into the interview say, and how did you feel about that, when they're already talking. And that's a different thing. I hope that's a different thing a little bit further down the line. But on the whole, it's something just to be mindful of what you are digging into there and what the reaction may be. And again, you know, talking to them beforehand, preparing them. It's quite hard in live interview situations, and we cover that because you've done a lot of live interviews where people go and they bleed on air for their allotted 2 minutes and then they leave. And terribly important, and I very much endorse this in the training that I do and in the book, that you prepare, have someone before they meet the presenter who prepares them beforehand for what areas they'd like to cover, briefs the presenter, and then is there for them afterwards to, if only if they maybe in tears or whatever, to bring them to comfort, but also to bring them back into the present time so that they're not there staying in that dreadful state, that they take some time to bring them forward. And often in a line of questioning, that can be, tell me about the campaign that you're running. So you're bringing them from that reliving moment into a more today and what they're doing in a more kind of motivated frame of mind.
You also talk about an ongoing relationship. So after that, you know, putting in a call to see sort of how they... Is that common?
Long-term relationships with interviewees is remarkably common, actually. And indeed, all the people, most of the people who are in the book, I've had a longer-term relationship. And I worked with three police widows. And when I mean, absolutely tragic stories. All of their husbands were killed on duty. The reason I sort of smile in the memory is because at the time, their children were very young and it was just the mums who talked. And I followed their stories over about 15 years. It must be longer than that now. And the reason I smile is because one of their daughters rang me with a story a few months ago. So it's almost not just months and years, but generations as well. You can actually end up following stories. And I think one of the reporters in the book describes how he had access to a pilot involved in the first Gulf War. And he was the only journalist this pilot would talk to because he treated the family respectfully. He didn't sort of pile around there. And then later he followed his journey back from, he was kept in, he'd been imprisoned and then he was released. And he followed his journey back to health and back to flying with the Red Arrows. And then his daughter became the first female pilot in the Red Arrows. And he followed that as well. So clearly over years. But what some journalists will do is just kind of check in with people. You know, they've shared this traumatic story. I advocate in the book, as you'll know, to when the piece is aired, when it's been broadcast or when it's been printed, published, just to text, WhatsApp, email, whatever your method of communication is, just to say thank you and give some positive feedback. Not many journalists do that, but it's actually incredibly effective, both personally, because it's a decent human thing to do, but also... you're the journalist they'll come back to with their follow-up stories, and often tragic stories really do run and run. And we have this sort of obligation not to just sort of parachute in there, get all the emotion and then go. In the follow-up chapters, one of the last child to be rescued from Aber Van talks very coherently about how communities can feel when journalists, and they've had five decades of anniversaries, journalists go in and parachute in and just get what they want and leave. And he's really articulate about the importance of just maintaining contact, respect, really.
As a journalist working at several places in your career, have demands ever been placed on you which have ended up making you feel that you've got to behave inappropriately to get the story, to get the piece?
Yes, and I think every journalist would probably say yes to that. There have been times when I have felt, in the past, I mean, overcompromised, and I've made mistakes. We all have, but then that's fundamental. We're not trained to get it right, other than now and through this book, hopefully. I'm hoping that it will give journalists a voice, as well as families, to stop the people who make the decisions over-compromising, almost like a Me Too journalist saying, yes, I've been over-compromised, I don't want to be. And there is this growing movement of journalists saying, look, I want to treat these people well. And actually, as Lucy Williamson, the BBC's Paris correspondent, is unequivocal about, and she's at the top of her game, and she says, you're a human being first, a reporter second.
How do you deal with that if you've spoken to someone whose story has just left you emotional, or you've actually been in a situation where a new story is happening around you? You know, you feel pretty awful.
Years ago, when I started in TV, I started to cover stories on domestic violence. Anyway, I came across the case of Emma Humphreys, a young lass who'd been incarcerated at 16, imprisoned, For killing her violent partner, who was twice her age. She was too afraid to give evidence at a trial, so she was sent to prison and had been there all her adult life up till 26. I met her, I don't think you could do this now, but through the campaign group Justice for Women, Emma was on a day out from prison and we arranged to meet up and do an interview, which was, I don't think you'd be allowed to do that now, I have no idea. Anyway, we met in a park and for the first time with very gentle, she was terrified, shaking, tiny, but very charismatic young girl. And she was able, on camera, for the first time, to tell her story, to give her side. 2 years later, after doing that interview and after the campaign group, I think they used some of my footage as well, I was on the steps of the Court of Appeal and Emma walked free, her conviction overturned. That was amazing. And I stood and I watched this young slip of a lass who'd had the worst kind of life you could ever imagine. Children's home to children's home, rape, you know, everything, the worst, dreadful treatment by the guy that she'd, she was cutting her wrists and she turned the knife on him and that's how he died. I stood on those steps and I watched her come out and it was a sunny day and the Justice for Women people with their banners were chanting and singing, "We have freed Emma Humphreys, yes we have." And we're not campaign journalists, but I did stand there and this tear just rolled down my face. I thought how incredible. It did bring about a change in the law for women who've been abused, or a shift in the law, and that was one heck of an achievement from someone who'd had nothing. And she inspired me. I wonder sometimes if she, in a sense, lived with me over the years and has added to the wealth of people whose stories I've touched on and covered, whose lives that you touch on, and inspire me just to give them a good deal, really.
Loads more in the book. We could talk for hours about it. Just give me some pointers of things we haven't talked about, which are covered off in the book, which we might find of interest.
I think the thing to say with the book is it follows the process of what we as reporters actually do when a story breaks. So how we approach, how we prepare, the relationship,
social media and picking up the phone, letter through letterbox, all that's in there, isn't it?
Yeah. How we film them is massively under-researched. And how we follow up their stories, and also, of course, how we write about them. So there's a whole chapter on the terminology that's acceptable and that isn't for all the different stories that we might cover. I think that's really important.
And you've got some outside sources writing on particular topics as well, haven't you?
Yes, I have a chapter on self-care. That actually is really important. So I've been focused, as I always am, on the families who've suffered the trauma. However, of course, this impacts on journalists, and I interviewed George, who was 83, and he wanted a voice in favour of euthanasia, but he was dying, and he died 2 days after we filmed with him. But when I went to film him, it was a few months earlier, I'd been with my father on his deathbed. So there was an awful lot of... There are times when these stories resonate for us, there are times when we're just covering loads of them. The impact on us can be quite hefty, which is not surprising, really. And therefore, there's a chapter on self-care by the excellent Dart Centre for Journalism and Trauma, an international organisation, and they are psychologists. Their Asia Pacific director talks about how to look after yourself, symptoms and things to look out for. And there's also a chapter from an academic, Dr. Sally Ann Duncan, about ethics and guidelines.